Muito bem.
Well, it's again good to be here. My apologies for missing the afternoon session. I had other matters. Thank you for Ajahn Kuslo to allow me my personal practice. I was quite exhausted, actually. Perhaps we could contemplate memory. When I began this practice, I had some sense of what was possible in the human heart. Not totally, obviously, but some sense that there is a very peaceful and compassionate way that one can live in this world. But to actually live that way was terribly difficult, because all the other things of greed, hatred, and delusion would usually dominate. So I came across the teaching, and my early entry into it was actually very intellectual. I was introduced to it by a monk who had a very honed sense of intellect, very, very sharp mind. And so it took me a while to get my head around the basic intellectual structures that we use, Patijasamupada, three characteristics, five khandhas, you know, all the four noble truths, etc., etc. So that's a piece that I think we all have to struggle with, because the concepts can seem so diverse, and to try to grasp them, well, what does that mean? And just like I find talking to people about the five khandhas, I can go over that again and again and again. People have trouble grasping what that actually means, getting their head around that. So that's the sort of intellectual work we all need to do. And that's very important, because if you have an intellectual sense of what the teaching is pointing to, that saves a lot of doubt. So there's that kind of doubt that we have, where intellectually we just kind of get, we really don't know how to inquire. We don't know what kind of questions to ask. And our minds can fall into doubts about the teaching itself, and so on and so forth. So in hearing the Dhamma and in reading about the Dhamma, that's one of the things that we do. Right? I was just casting back to what, say, I was talking about Ajahn Kuslo, about just the kinds of teachings you do get. You get sometimes just very, very intellectual structures being presented to you, which then help inform you about your own inquiry. Sometimes the instruction I got from Ajahn Chah was basically hang in. You know, it wasn't terribly like, go to him with the problems I was having. He said, like I always joke, he'd say, gum, karma, hang in there. You know, you haven't developed your mind, you've lived a sloppy life, so this is the result. You've got a sloppy mind. You got to live morally, you got to get your act together, you got to meditate, and until you do that, you're just going to have a rough time. So, gum, hang in there. And what else could he say? You know, he could give me all the abstruse, refined definitions of this and that, but basically I just had to hang in. There's just some rough times to go through. And so sometimes the teaching is that. It doesn't seem like much, but it's actually profound. If I'm going through hell, what's he going to say? Well, if you contemplate the, you know, the 16th jhana and the 4th aspect of things, I'm going through hell. And just that was very compassionate, actually, just to say, well, it'll work, but you gotta hang in there. gone. Mm. Well, and so sometimes you just say, otong, endure. A lot of the Thai teaching, when I think about it, and you go to the teacher and you're falling apart, he says, yeah, endure. Otong, otong. And it wasn't a very refined statement made, but it was appropriate. Appropriate time and place. So if you have a rough time, you can say hang in there. But it's also kind of fun to think about Dhamma. That's important. Just say that when I come here, I always, like I've lived in monasteries a lot, now I'm living with my dear old mum in a condominium, and when I come back into a monastic environment now, it is just so delightful, Not that my life with my mum is not delightful, that also has its beauty, but I am very much a monastic, because it's been my adult life. And so it's very easy for me to feel grateful to the all of you who have contributed so much in so many ways, and to all the lay people who have made this possible, and to Ajahn Chah and to Buddha, because this is really quite an extraordinary thing to be involved in. But I know in my monastic life I've often just got caught up with the details of building projects and problems people were going through, and committee meetings, and the whole sense of wonder and beauty and the extraordinary opportunity we have often got lost, and a sense of gratitude would of course drowned out, and more a sense of, oh, there's too much work, or people are too noisy, or blah 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 blah. So the judging mind, the complaining mind, sometimes would dominate, which isn't a very happy state of affairs. So in contemplating memory, memory is a very, very important part of human consciousness, and to understand memory, to understand how to use memory, is a very important part of practice. So you can see when I come into this environment, I remember something. I remember your goodness. I remember your hard work. I remember the hard work that has gone into creating this. I remember Ajahn Sumedho's goodness in coming out and doing what he's done, Ajahn Chah and so on. So I recollect something. Which is a power of the mind. We have this capacity to recollect things, but also we have the tendency to remember in a very heedless way, don't we? So I can be meditating, and the mind can just go off into remembering that I'm supposed to be doing something next week, and how am I going to be doing that? Maybe I shouldn't be doing that, or remembering some resentment. So there can be memory as bad habit. If you look at something like a person who was just remembering some argument that happened and just dwelling on that in a resentful way, that's memory. But it's not memory as recollection, it's memory as just bad habit, and it causes suffering. So memory is a huge part of our conscious experience, and part of, I think, right understanding is understanding memory. When we say someone has right understanding or right view, it's not simply a doctrinal understanding of a Dhamma, but it's also it's a personal experiential understanding of how the mind works. Because if we can understand how the mind works, then we can apply appropriate effort, we can work with the laws of the mind, as it were, for liberation and freedom. So right understanding isn't simply taking some intellectual structures and trying to shove our consciousness into those as a sort of a willful attempt to mold our minds according to some intellectual principles. And that's what Western culture has done a lot. You just take some kind of ideas and then you shove yourself the way you should be into that. But rather, right understanding is really understanding how the mind works. So within that, understanding emotions, understanding the body, and understanding, in this case, say, memory. So memory, say, when you, this kind of functional memory that we have, like when you, if you're driving a car, you're driving along the street, when you see a red light, that red light tells you to stop the car. And that's memory, isn't it? You know, all very complex memory which tells you to stop the car. If you didn't have that, you'd be in an accident. So we have all kinds of functional memory. We remember each other. I remember, you know, the difference between Jaya and Ajahn Kusala. They're different people. Functional memory, there's that. There's a kind of narrative memory that I have. I am Viradhammo, and tomorrow Alan's going to take me to town, and I have an appointment on Thursday. So there's that kind of narrative memory also. So memory is quite vast, and sometimes Buddhism sounds like you shouldn't have any memory, just live in the present moment, which would be an absolute catastrophe. And we see that with somebody with Alzheimer's, totally in the present moment, but with no narrative, no context. So that's not what we're talking about. If you don't have any context, you are, we have dementia, right? We have to have context. We need a narrative that we live in. There's that, you probably, those of you who kind of read a bit about the mind, that example of a man who in the 1950s had a very serious, extreme, debilitating epilepsy, and the doctors were desperate to do something. So the very last thing they thought they could do is they did some neurosurgery and they cut out a part of his brain. I think it was the hippocampus. And unfortunately at that time they didn't know that that part of the brain is what creates memory. And this man lost the capacity to create new memory. So he was always, always 28 years old from then on. He lived for another 30 years. And he'd look in a mirror and he'd see a 60-year-old man. He'd be shocked, look away, but then he'd forget. Because he couldn't create a new memory. And he was, you know, he had to be institutionalized because he was always, he was always 28 years old. Weird. So some interesting things. So the kind of New Age idea that you're always present is a bit silly, isn't it? You're always just present with no sense of history. So we have in the way we talk about our life as Buddhists, we have narrative, we have the sense of self, and that's the kind of social dharma. So in terms of Vinaya is the social dharma that Ajahn Kusala and I live, and that's the way we relate to you through our discipline. So I am senior, and Ajahn Kusala is junior to me. And then when Venerable Pavaro comes, and Venerable Pavaro will be junior, and Ajahn Kusala will be senior. And that's the kind of narrative that we remember and that we live by. And that's where the sense of me plays out in our lives. So Buddhism does have a sense of I, a sense of person, that defines our social relationships. So I am a man, and so I have certain rules around women as a monk. And I am a son, so I have a relationship to my mother, and so on and so forth. And so that narrative plays up, and that's called the conventional reality or conventional truth. And that's very important, not to be dismissed. Oh, that's just conventional truth, right? You're just a man, right? So, but you're just a monk. But actually, you can drop conventional truth and go to the pub. And no, you can't. Conventional truth is very important. Sila is very important. Our hierarchy is important, not as ultimate truth, but as a social way of living together in harmony and so on and so forth. And then the Dharma. So when the Buddha passed away, he said, "I leave you the Dhamma Vinaya," and that's quite often what lay people maybe don't take on board as much as we do as monastics, is that the Buddha did just leave a transcendent teaching about phenomena and the liberation from phenomena, but he also gave a very social teaching. So I leave you the Dhamma Vinaya. If he just left the Dhamma, that would only be part of teaching. I leave you the Dhamma Vinaya. So he left a particular way that the Sangha should live together, a suggestion which lay people participate in. And then so that's important. And then the other is more about the phenomenology of consciousness, how the mind works, and this particular wonderful realization he had of liberation from phenomena, the unconditioned or the uncreated or nibbana. And so when we use memory, I remember who I am in my sense of Vinaya, in my social sense. But also, in developing Dhamma, I use this capacity for recollection, for letting go of the narrative. There's a kind of paradox there. So when I sit and I meditate, if I'm just in a narrative, that's not very good samadhi, is it? If I'm always thinking about myself and who I am and what I'm going to be doing, then obviously I'm not really practicing letting go. So there is letting go of the narrative, but there's also living as the narrative. It's a kind of paradox. And both are necessary. But the skill, of course, is to be able to drop the narrative when appropriate and then contemplate the Dhamma. And that's what we're doing all the time. So actually we're doing both. So even though the narrative is that I am senior and Ajahn Kusala is junior, if within that narrative I'm being noxious or manipulative or domineering or fearful, then within that I have to liberate my heart from that. In terms of using memory then for Dhamma, what we're learning to do and what we're continuing to do is learning to live this narrative of ours, live this social life of ours in terms of the Four Noble Truths. So what we're doing with memory then is we're recollecting or we're remembering suffering and the abandonment of suffering. In the Four Noble Truths, the essential ingredient is non-grasping. So in the study part of the mind, we come to some understanding of the second and third noble truths. So hopefully by now you understand that. Because if you haven't figured that one out, then you should get your head around that, because that's that intellectual part is just absolutely essential to any kind of authentic practice. Second, third noble truth. There's the attachment to craving, there's the abandonment to craving. That's the key. So then, what we're doing, once we've figured that out, because it is a kind of figuring out, continually we're recollecting that. We're remembering non-grasping, recollection of non-grasping. Now that's a different use of memory. It's bringing up into consciousness Dharma, remembering Dharma. So it's not like a kind of narrative of what I'm going to do in time, but it's always very present. And very much in line with truth. Now, the whole sense of what non-grasping means is not, is something that I think should be in your practice, something which isn't just an intellectual idea, but actually is an embodied idea. Because in what letting go means, or non-grasping means, isn't simply an idea, but it's something that you feel. When I grasp craving, I don't just do it intellectually. I do it emotionally, I do it in thought, I do it physically, the body is contracted or whatever. So the whole sense of remembering what letting go is should become, as we practice, more and more profound. Not simply an idea, but an embodied sense of what that means. So I ask you that, I don't expect an answer rhetorically. Do you know what letting go means? Right here now. Do you know what that means in your body? Do you know what that means emotionally? Do you know what that means in thought? Because if you do, then practice is quite simple. Just let go. So in that Ajahn Chah, a video from Chithurst, the producer asks Ajahn Chah, so what's it about? What's Buddhism about? He says, Ploy Wan. And it translates as let go. And the radio announcer says, what do you mean by letting go? Ajahn Chah just chuckles, let go. And it's that simple, just let go. Now intellectually, you can spin that around into probably treatises and PhDs and all the rest of it, books on emptiness and all that. But the visceral sense of that, the immediate realization of that, the constant remembering of that, the continual recollection of that is the practice. And that's what you're doing all the time. You just let go. So it's very helpful to, first of all, I mean, it's helpful to intellectually understand third noble truth, the second, third noble truth, what craving is, what the attachment to craving is, and what the abandonment of craving is, in your own psyche, in your own emotional states, in your own body. What does that actually mean? And to recognize that, to recognize, this is letting go. This is non-grasping, it feels this way. And that's the third noble truth. There is the realization, there is nirodha, the realization of the cessation of grasping, the cessation of craving. And you could look at that as some kind of final product, but you can also see there are moments where there is this liberation from becoming. There is this freedom from casting back and forward in the future, this whole grasping mind. And that is the touchstone of your practice, that sense that this is just the way it is now, it's just perfect. So the basic recollection, the basic use of memory, which we employ in Buddhism, is this is the way it is now. And that sounds like such utter, like a tautology, right? It's how else could it be? But really, if you contemplate how profound it is to remember exactly the way this moment is, not as an idea, this is hot, this is cold, this is good, this is bad, this is better, this is worse, with all the judging mind, but actually just this way, it's just this way now. And that's the root recollection which we have in terms of establishing the practice. So that's the, you get hammered with that constant, don't you? 2,600 years, people have been reminded, this is the way it is now. This is the way it is now. But realize the profundity of that, especially when your mind is just scattered, or when your mind is just judging everyone, and it's too much of this, or there's too much of that, and she's like this, and he's like that, blah, 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 blah. That's not awareness, that's judging. But to actually come to the sense, oh, this is judgment, this is self, this is other, that, this is time, this is memory, yeah? To actually know this is what it feels like. And that's grasping, and that's holding, that's attachment, that's suffering. To actually awaken to that, it's very, very profound. It's very easy to just abide and say, like judging. One can spend days judging oneself in self-criticism. And it might seem all very right, but it's not awareness. Or judging others, or worrying, or fantasizing, all the things that we can get into. And yet in a split second, one wakes up and says, oh, this is the way it is now. And then what happens? And then what do you do? Does one really then abide in this non-grasping? Or does anyone grasp the idea that one shouldn't be judging? Or grasp the idea that it's true, or whatever it might be? So, another rhetorical question, do you have a bodily sense of that in your practice? Do you have a sense of ease that you can return to or recollect? And can you make that strong in your practice? And I've been pondering this, how the different teachers I've met, how they all seem to have maybe developed ways where, if they really honed one aspect of conscious experience which reminds them, or which they recollect, is the letting go. So, like typically, say if you think about Ajahn Sumedho's teaching, how when you're with him, he's always, asking people to, do you hear the sound of silence? Not demanding it, but just as a way of relaxing the mind into emptiness. Other teachers will talk about the breath. And those things are just the particular ways that I think teachers develop of recollecting the letting go, or feeling letting go. But they're very simple, but they're very profound for the practitioner. They short-circuit all that kind of thinking and analyzing, all that stuff which we do in the beginning, to a very simple, just let go. And what does that mean? So there has to be some memory of that. Not memory as narrative, but memory as bodily sense. Memory as softness. I was talking with someone on Friday, yeah, that was yesterday. Went for a long walk with a new person to the group at the Quaker House, and we're both talking about that when the mind has there is a strong sense of ease, there is non-grasping, there's a kind of softness to the whole practice. And just that, just taking softness as the sign of letting go, is an embodied recollection. It's something that you embody as your practice. If the practice just remains intellectual all the time, we're always judging and analyzing, that is really quite superficial, because thought is quite not in contact with the way things are. Thought's always secondary. My description of this watch, if I say that's cool and hard, is different than the touch of it, isn't it? Right. This is a color of, this is a carpet which is largely red in tone. I mean, red is just a word, but actually the experience of that is such. Right. So if our practice is simply linguistic verbiage going on in the mind. And that still seems to me quite a long way from really how things are. But if we can use language to really bring us to a very precise sense of how things are, then we're using language in the way of recollection. So language which is simply judging things. So if I'm practicing and I'm feeling upset about something, and then I'm just judging myself, oh gosh, why are you upset? And they shouldn't be like that, blah, 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 blah. There's no real mindfulness there. It's just attachment to thought. But if I then recollect the Dhamma, I say, I wonder what the feeling is in my face. Then that kind of language takes me to a more direct sense of what's actually going on, and a more direct sense of what letting go implies. So we use language not simply to... I think most people just think a lot about themselves. And that's not awareness. If I just think a lot about my patterns and my habits, that's not really awareness. It's just thinking, it's just narcissistic. So Buddhist practice isn't narcissistic. It's not to create a stronger sense of my own neuroses. What's the point of it? Right? But it's to use language and thought as recollection, to take you to letting go. So if you take something like I was saying yesterday, what if we would just use this lifetime for the recollection of kindness? What if we forgot about enlightenment? And we just said, well, if for this lifetime, I'm going to get in touch with a sense of kindness, what it feels like, and then I'm just going to do that for one lifetime. I'll do kindness. So use this lifetime as a vehicle for the cultivation of kindness. That's simple. That's quite simple. Much simpler than all the blah, blah, blah in the mind. Right? And then I actually, first of all, I actually understand what kindness is. Not to say that, say, we are unkind. You know, we offer each other cups of tea, and if I slip on the ice, you'll help me off the ice, right? You won't kick me in the head when I'm down. So we're not unkind, but to take kindness to a really deep level, not simply the accidents of kindness which we all rise to, that's easy. Otherwise we wouldn't be here, we're all cruel kind of beasts. But actually to take something like kindness and really make it a profound part of letting go. So that what would that imply? That means you'd have to really understand kindness as like the softness in the body, the attitude in the mind, the way of listening. You have to really know what kindness is. And if you really know that, right, and then apply that to everything. Apply it to opening the door. Apply it to shoveling the snow. Apply it to listening to someone who is boring. Apply it to someone who talks too much, talks too little. Apply it to someone who forgot to clean the toilet. Apply, you know, to constantly take a practice. Now that's very powerful. That's very powerful. And it's not just, it takes a lot of intention. You have to constantly recollect. Right? It's not terribly intellectual. It's not stupid. It's wise. But it's not wrapped up with a lot of clever thought. But it has great power. Why does it have great power? Because it's a kind of recollection of a deep part of what we mean by wholesomeness. And you can see how fear is not kind. The judging mind is not kind. The anger is not kind. Greed is not kind. Overeating is not kind. Undereating is not kind. Pushing yourself is not kind. It's none of that. It's kindness. Vegging out is not kind. Depression is not kind. So all those negative states, when they're contrasted against something simple like kindness, very simple. But do it. You know, try to sit for an hour and be kind. I mean, it's very hard because the mind becomes unkind. It worries, or the knees start to hurt, and fidgets, and so on. So actually, to be kind for an hour. Now, what does that do? Well, and it doesn't have to be kindness. It could be the sound of silence. It could be something like patience, whatever you chose. But it would have to be a choosing which was integrated with a deep understanding of letting go, which was in line with the second and third noble truths. And I think it would be particular to one's own sense of what the work is and what one needs to do, right? But if one then picks something up like that as a practice, and really hones that. What does that do? Well, then the power of recollection becomes strengthened by the doing. If each time something happens in the monastery or in life which I don't like, and each time I react to that with aversion, then what I'm strengthening is the power to recollect aversion, and I become a victim of that, right? But if each time something happens in the mind which I don't like, and I recollect forgiveness and kindness, then what happens is the strength of forgiveness and kindness begins to have a power in my mind. And the more I do it, the more it has power. So I either give power to the wholesome, or I give power to the unwholesome. Now, this doesn't dismiss my social life. In the narrative of life, I may have to say to someone, I'm sorry, that's inappropriate. I can still forgive, I can still be kind. But I'm in the narrative of my life, my response to me might say, sorry, you have to leave, you're misbehaving. I can deal with kindness, hard, but maybe that's necessary, that's fine. So, in the narrative of life, we have criticism, we have judgment. But in the heart of letting go, there's a difference. And if you look at the Buddhist teaching around the Metta Sutta, that each one of us tries to develop a kindness for all sentient beings that a mother has for her only child. And you think about that, it's impossible. And it's very, very, very high teaching, but that's what the teaching's saying. Right? That's what it's saying. So if we're going to take it, we're going to take the challenge. Kindness doesn't imply that we don't like things, like, dislike. Kindness is something that is above, you know, it's something about the heart. So it's something the way we listen and relate to life. So if one were to do that, to take up a practice, and one could see that it was an entry into letting go, and one understood that, then the intellect would be in line with that. Intellectually, it would not be doubtful. You just know this is it. This is what you're supposed to be doing, and the practice gets actually quite straightforward. It's no longer complicated. It's very simple. It's just do this for a lifetime. And if you think about the way, again, if you think about how the mind moves in patterns of memory. And I was recollecting in the meeting last night at Quaker House this lovely story which I think Kusala's heard too many times, but he's very compassionate. When we first went to London, 1977, we were in a very socially disharmonious situation. There was disharmony on many levels. We had come from Thailand, which is a Buddhist country, you'll remember, and we were in London, which is not a Buddhist country. It was cold, it was raining. Lay people were having some kind of internecine warfare. And poor old Ajahn Sumedho was just sort of reeling from that. pub across the road. One guy came in and ripped the Donna box off the wall and walked out with it. Upstairs from the pub, rock music being practiced, very loud. Edwardian windows, 11 foot tall. Very lovely views, but not much protection from noise. And most of the lay people found it the noisiest place they've ever meditated in. Their homes were much quieter. So the upshot of that was that I was very depressed. And my whole heart, I just want to go back to Thailand. I did not want to be here. I didn't ask to be here. Chasim, I didn't want to be there. Ajahnanda, also very, very depressed. He already had his escape route planned. He knew which hotel he was going to. And Ajahn Sumedho was also, it was difficult for him. And we were just getting so negative. And so the, you know, speaking of memory, then the mind had become, had memorized a pattern of grumbling and complaining and moaning. And everything just had become quite, at least for me, negative. So Ajahn Sumedho then instituted a really tough regime. So I said, okay, enough of this nonsense. So 3 o'clock, he got up and took a cold shower. And then he knocked on Anando's door. And Anando took a cold shower. And then they knocked on my door. And I do not like cold showers. I like warm duvets. This is my preference. And Ananda knocked on my door, and the only way I could do this was by screaming. If I thought about it for 30 seconds, I'd be under the duvet. But since they had done it, I had to do it. So. Have a cold shower. But then an hour of very rigorous yoga. Ajahn Sumedho is a very good yogi. And so he put us through like 15-minute headstands and things. Oh, no. And then a 2-hour sit. And then breakfast. Now, you can imagine the vigor which had to be applied to make it through to breakfast. And every morning we would go out on alms round. So we'd go out, and usually it seemed like it always rained, and it was always cold. And you'd go out with the umbrella, right? And you'd go with the alms. Now, Haverstock Hill, which is a very noisy street. And people looking at you like you're this absolute freak. And a policeman once asked me to open up my bowl. I said, what's in there? Mm-hmm. What's in the bowl? Mm-hmm. Nothing. but the insight for me was after doing this kind of rigorous practice, that first morning, it was raining again, it was the same town, it was the same pollution, the same, and I opened the door of the Vihara to go out an alms round, and the first thought was, ugh, what am I doing here, London? It was a depressed thought. But the second thought was, no way, I'm not falling into that hell realm again. And I just determined, no, I'm going to do metta practice. I remember walking on the street saying, you'll be well, you'll be well, you'll be well, you'll be well. And just saying metta to every face I met, because they had to go to work, I didn't. They actually looked miserable. And the mind switched, right? The mind switched. And it had, and that's how memory works, doesn't it? You know, memory just isn't like me remembering, but it's a kind of pathway. That if it's unskillful, it just burns us. It just burns us. And sometimes it's really hard to lift the mind out of bad memory patterns. And that's what, you know, that was the kindness of Ajahn Sumedho in kind of introducing this discipline. And he always did things first, and he did kind of say, you do it and I'll get under the duvet. But you can see how that there is a price to pay for attachment. We pay the price in the moment of suffering, but then we compound the interest because we deepen the root, the pathways of suffering. And there's, of course, a reward for lifting the mind out of that. And there's a kind of urgency in that, isn't there? There's an urgency of saying, no, that's the path to suffering, that's a path to hell, whatever it is. So if one has then a simple way of recollecting the Dhamma, recollecting the present moment, recollecting an embodied sense of what letting go is, and I think again I keep returning to that, that it seems to me we should employ our whole being, not just some intellectual abstract about what letting go is, but a felt sense, a heart sense, a body sense, a breath sense of what letting go is. It seems to me we have so much equipment that informs us about what attachment and non-attachment is. Yeah, there's so much that our kind of intuitive sense, our bodily sense can notice the arising of grasping and attachment. There's so much there. Our culture can remain very intellectual, which seems to me a loss. So if one can then, in the sitting, like, if liberation means the letting go of craving, why not say right in that moment, well, this is it, I'm liberated. Why not recollect that now? Why wait? And what would that mean? If you just recollect, well, there's nothing to do. You have to be present now. You have nothing to do and actually be doing something about thinking about the future. You have to be present. But in that moment you say, well, there's nothing else to do. Wouldn't that be non-craving? And what would that feel like? Wouldn't that feel like to think and to feel that there's actually nothing to do? What would you feel like? Well, you have to try. I don't know. But when I do that, I feel very good because there's nothing to do. But it's thinking I have to do something that's actually tension, grasping, becoming, getting rid of, blah, 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 analyzing, figuring out. It's just this way. Or imagine if you got enlightened tomorrow, what would you feel? You'd probably feel a bit of gratitude. So rather than waiting tomorrow, why not feel gratitude now? Just recollect, oh, it's gratitude. That's not the same as saying, you should be grateful for living at Tisser in a monastery, I've sweated over a hot cushion, you should be grateful to me. That's rubbish. But actually, the embodied sense of gratitude, what is that like? And that's different than the idea, the mental, that you have to, the should be mind, I should be grateful, it's just an idea. It's not an embodied sense of gratitude, but the embodied sense of gratitude. So that I do a meeting with the Toronto people every fortnight over the phone now. So that was Thursday. We phone them up and we have a reading and they send me questions on the internet and then I talk over the phone and I hear these disembodied voices and they hear my disembodied voice. But anyway, Curtis was the week before saying, is there a way in Buddhism you can kind of fake it until you make it? And if you think about it, well, actually, maybe the whole path is that. So rather than waiting for that moment of gratitude when I'm enlightened, why not just be grateful? Why not recollect gratitude? And rather than waiting for that moment when I had no more desire, why not just let go of desire now? You see what I mean? So if you have a real, like a deep sense of what second and third noble truth means, what that implies, well, why not just keep doing that, recollecting that in a felt sense? And then it seems to me that we are continually coming to that realization of Nirodha. And then the final whammy, okay, whenever or however, it doesn't really matter, if it falls how it falls, but to actually put it in place each moment seems to me a kind of very direct way of practicing. There's a rigor in that. It's not airy-fairy. It's not like a new age, oh, everyone's lovely, right? It's very rigorous in the sense that you keep doing it, but it's not blind with willpower. it's imbued with wisdom and understanding. All right, leave that for you to ponder. Sharing the name.